Hello, this is Mike Harbath with this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. As a reminder, Revenue Rocket is the world's premier growth strategy and M&A advisor for IT services firms. Today, I have my partner Ryan Barnett with me. Hello, Ryan.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me on today. You know, it's been a busy week and a busy year, 2021, for anyone who's engaging in any kind of M&A, especially in the IT services market. You know, we came out of 2020 pretty hot with people looking and understanding that the IT services market is something where there's good revenue streams, there's good profitability, and they essentially survived. So we are seeing a lot of companies look to the market for consolidation, whether either buying another company or selling their own company. And when they go to the market and look for it, buyers and sellers have a number of options of how they can take and tackle the approach of going to market. So, Mike, today I'd love to understand what are different ways in which buyers are looking to acquire companies, and who are the people that they're working with to help establish deal flow and really get M&A cooking. So I'd like to just open up high level of what you're seeing, and we can dig in from there.
Yeah, you know, in a competitive market, you have a couple choices. It's certainly, I would argue, it's a seller's market. And in a seller's market, there's more buyers than sellers. And so it's competitive. It's challenging. And there's a couple approaches that you can take if you're a buyer, right? You can kind of wait for a sell side broker to contact you with a teaser, or a brief on a company. However, oftentimes when you receive those things, you know, as a buyer, it might be too late, or it might be in a situation where there's 30 or more buyers. We've seen that commonly occur. For most, sell side mandates, in our case, our own sell side mandates, but also for others where we're representing buyers. If for whatever reason they targeted a specific firm and we did discovery on them and they were in the middle of a sell side process, it's, you know, you're one of many. We think there's a better way. And we execute on that better way, by doing very targeted outreach to companies that are not for sale and running a buy side process that's meaningful, that will allow you to target companies that are ideal fits versus just those that are opportunistic fits. And we think oftentimes that it makes the difference between a successful deal that achieves its internal rate of return long term and an unsuccessful deal. Because the likelihood that a deal is going to be a perfect fit for you from a strategic perspective and cultural and financial perspective, if represented by a seller and you're just taking sort of an opportunistic view of the market, you know, is actually markedly pretty low. And so we think it's better to do it more proactively and to do it in a way that has meaningful outreach.
Yeah, you know, it's, when you see firms that are for sale, it's not necessarily that they're bad firms or that someone shouldn't be for sale. We represent firms for sale all the time. We always have a mandate for a firm for sale. And there are perfect times in which a company has found opportunities for them to expand and go to market. I think what you're mentioning, Mike, is that when a firm does package themselves up for sale and they do go to market, there's increased competition and there's a different mindset in which the seller and buyer engage each other. And that mindset may not be beneficial for long-term strategic growth. And because they've already, they're focusing on perhaps the highest valuation or the highest, a seller selling at the highest valuation or highest, the best fit for their firm, and they offers different control over calling up someone out of the blue and saying, hey, are you interested in a merger? Are you looking at optimizing your growth with another party? I think that's an interesting thing to consider. Package companies aren't necessarily bad, but understanding there's competitive risk with all packaged companies. Mike, if I think about, you know, the type of people in which you can work with in this ecosystem, can you tell me a little bit about investment bankers and typically how they might help someone buy a company?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of confusion around, you know, is someone an investment bank or is someone an M&A advisor or how does that work? You know, and it is somewhat nuanced, right? I think in many ways they play similar but different roles. Oftentimes M&A advisors don't have the depth of financial resources to really help make an investment decision. That's not always the case, but it certainly is oftentimes the case. And then there's, you know, certainly FINRA licensing, which comes into play, which, you know, for almost all small transactions, particularly buy side transactions, licensing is not really a factor. But I, you know, would argue that, you know, investment bankers, such as our firm, are ones that can provide a full service, not just sourcing deals, not just matchmaking, not just advising on process, but can actually do for you an outsourced corporate development function. And that outsourced corporate development function is really important because as a buyer, regardless of whether you're a large company or a small company, you need a team of people to play all those functions, everything from traditional M&A advisory to outreach to financial analysis and valuation functions to legal review to due diligence and to facilitating and assisting with business negotiations. And the world is kind of filled with people that live along that continuum. Firms like us that do the full service to people that, you know, do deals on contingency, but all they do is matchmake. And the challenge with that certainly is one that, you know, comes with, fraught with, you got to fill in the blanks with other advisors, or other people. And so, you know, we think it's appropriate to use a full service firm. It makes your life a lot easier as a buyer. Or a seller for that matter, and it can help you expedite getting deals done.
Sure. Mike, I want to dig into that a little bit. So if you're talking about, there's different models to an advisory firm and an investment bank and or even a list service or even a third-party marketplace. And I'd love to kind of, can you just help educate myself and the market on what are ways that you typically engage these different companies? You had mentioned a non-contingent broker. So maybe let's start with that. What is a non-contingent broker?
Well, I should more accurately say a contingent broker, a broker that, you know, maybe I misspoke there, but someone who just works on a success fee only. So we call it a contingent upon a transaction happening. And there's a lot of what I call single shingle guys or small firms that will do that. And they're just trying to be a matchmaker. They're trying to network their way into a deal and put people together and say, hey, I heard that, you know, Bob's firm is going to be for sale and you're a buyer. And so I'm a matchmaker. So I'll point you guys together and we'll record that I made the matchmake. And if it happens, then you can pay me a fee, right? And the challenge with that is it's still fraught with all of the problems and risks, associated with doing the deal on your own. And as I said in previous podcasts, there's only a 1% chance you're going to get a deal done if you do it on your own versus if you use a investment bank or M&A advisor who has a more full service approach. And so, you know, contingent fees sound great because it's like, hey, we don't got to pay unless we get the deal done. But you should know the likelihood of getting that deal done is very low. It's actually 1 in 100, even if they point to a very, very good fit. So you have to understand their business model. Their business model is to just connect as many people as possible over a period of time and hope that they get a few deals a year done. You know, and as one of my business mentors taught me, pretty early on, you know, hope is not a plan, and, it's tough to align there to be successful. Where certainly it's also kind of a get what you pay for market, right? You're talked to a lot of people that say, hey, we're really happy to pay a fee if we successfully get the deal done. Well, I'm sure you are, but there's a lot that goes into that that someone has to do. So, you know, there's qualifying and fit analysis and outreach and financial analysis and valuation work and, you know, architecting the deal and writing the LOI and doing due diligence and all that stuff. And contingent brokers don't do that stuff. So you have to know that, you know, kind of what you're getting into when you look at that. You know, respectable M&A brokers and investment banks charge for their services. They typically charge for those services with a retainer, either upfront or over time, and a success fee, and then they provide a full suite of services. And beyond that, there's, you know, players in the market that are more effective than others, and I think that's where, as a buyer of those services, you have to be, you know, a little bit buyer beware. You have to look at these firms with a lot of scrutiny to determine that they're going to align with what you need.
Yeah, I think one of the key components to the contingent crew is that you have to be careful of any kind of exclusivity of using one. We have seen some firms in which they will take a deal on a contingent basis, but then lock up the client in a long-term relationship. So there might be a multi-year tail if any kind of introduction is done, even though the value is not provided. And the other
part, and even if it's not, that brings up a great point, Ryan. You know, there are fewer of these arrangements, but they still do exist. Really, any exclusive arrangement with an M&A advisor or an investment bank, we think is not in your best interest. And we certainly don't require that. Some do. And the problem with that is that if someone locks you up as a seller, as an example, and doesn't perform for you at the time of the contract, and writes a 2, 3, 5 year tail and you sell to someone else without them, you still owe them a fee. And that is a huge overreach, in my opinion, for someone asking for a fee for some work, for work they didn't do. Now their argument is, well, we got you ready to be sold. We gave you advice on how to be packaged to be sold and all this stuff. But, if they didn't actually find the buyer or assist with transacting the deal, I don't think they should expect to be paid. So, now, on the other hand, there are tails in contracts where if someone did make an introduction and that transaction came after the project was done, and it was within a reasonable period of time, then, you know, that advisor should be paid. And the reason they should is because they provided the value in the, per the contract. So, you know, there's some gray areas here, but the thing to be careful of is an exclusive contract that would lock you up as a seller to sell to anyone, versus someone that would sell to someone that broker introduced you to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think the other thing to consider is just simply from a business standpoint, when you're using a contingent broker who's relying only on kind of the elephant fees, you know, you're eating one elephant a year kind of fee structure, it's tough for them to maintain a team that's needed in order to get a deal done. So there's typically a research team that's needed to go find and source accounts. There's an outreach team that's needed to gather intelligence and make calls and introduction. There's a program team that keeps those targets alive. And there's a financial analysis team. And it's really hard to have the structure of a company like that if you're only getting one deal or two deals done a year and those are contingent. It's hard to feed a family when you don't know if that deal is coming or not. So we'd advise to take a look at the structures and understanding that the work of what when you are if you are paying some type of retainer, the retainer is being put to work across a number of different functions. Some which you see visibly, some which you don't every day. Each person has a plays their part throughout the process as you go through it. And Mike, I guess the other part, the other question I have, we don't have to belabor this too much or this topic too much today, but when you look at the advisors that are out there, love to hear your advice on a legal advisor, you know, using a legal team to run a M&A process. You know, our ideal, they tend to get into minutia and help you out and play a valuable part in the M&A process. But Mike, what challenges or what have you seen with law firms being M&A driven? What are some things you've seen there?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think, you know, obviously you have to have a trusted M&A attorney that's working on your behalf in getting any transaction done. It's a requirement. They're part of the advisory team, as is a good CPA and tax advisor. Those are critical components beyond an M&A advisor. The thing that's fascinating about that is several law firms, you know, there's been, I don't want to say a glut of lawyers, but certainly there's a lot of lawyers out there. There's a lot of lawyers practicing law, and law firms have waded into this M&A world a little bit beyond just doing transaction documentation. They've waded into putting deals together. They've waded into trying to be sourcing deals. And oftentimes, as much as the, you know, certainly they're able to do that, they're conflicted in the role because the M&A advisor, you know, a big value that an M&A advisor investment bank plays for you is one that is to facilitate the negotiations from a position of experience and sort of middle ground, right? I often say we spend a lot of time bringing the ends to the middle. To find fair middle grounds on points that can be contentious. And oftentimes that business negotiation and experience is in conflict with how to document to do the deal in a lower risk or low risk way, which is what the lawyer should do, right? So an M&A attorney, a smart one, is focused on mitigating the risk, but also balancing, you know, getting the deal done. Because the best way to mitigate the risk is to blow the deal up, and that's not in anyone's interest. So we do see conflict in lawyers that act as M&A advisors trying to balance, you know, the business negotiations with the legal negotiations. And oftentimes an objective third party, someone that's outside of the legal negotiations, is better suited to sort of determine the intent of the parties and then help the lawyers craft the legal documents around the intent versus the other way around, where you craft more of a legal view and sometimes you lose the intent of the parties in that process.
Yeah, it's a great point. And sometimes, same with an accounting firm, you get just a different view. You know, they're critically important in the acquisition process. And we don't see a lot of accounting firms be M&A advisors, but we certainly have run across a few. Just keep in mind the angle that they're using to go about it. And then, Mike, I'll just ask the last question. What about going alone on either buy side or sell side? What do you think? Is that is it possible? Can you do it, or do you at all costs kind of find some help, even if it might be a bank or a law firm?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, we'll take the anti-Nike slogan, just don't do it. I think that it is critically important for you to understand the real risk associated with that. You know, there is only statistically a 1% chance you'll get that deal done. There is a 99% chance you will not. without an advisor of some sort helping you. And the reason that is, you know, as we've said before, this is considered the most unnatural act in business. You would think as a business owner or a leader, how hard can it be? I should be able to do it. However, there's so, so much to know, that, you know, things like how these are deals are typically structured and how to create sort of a structure that makes sense and a structure is built properly to have a win-win and to do the financial analytics properly to gauge the return rates and to negotiate specific deal points, and to keep the thing moving when things look like they're going to stall. It is a very, very challenging role. And so, you know, there's a reason why big corporations typically use a corporate development group, department inside their business to kind of move these along. And not the CEO or the CFO to manage the process. And that's because it takes a village, if you will. And it takes a set of experiences that any one individual probably doesn't have. And it's a group of people with different types of skills that really have to come together to do this. You know, now could you assemble a team as someone who wanted to do this on their own? Yeah, you could, but it's going to cost you far more than using a outside firm that does this every day and who's skilled and experienced. So, you know, if you're simply looking at risk mitigation and increasing your odds of getting a deal done, the business case is clearly there to use an outside firm, that has great experience in your industry. And someone who, you trust can help you get it done.
Great. Makes sense. Mike, that's all the questions I've got for you today.
Sounds great, Ryan. Thanks. And with that, we're going to tie a ribbon on it for this week, at the end of June in 2021. Everybody out there have a great and safe, holiday weekend here and the 4th of July. If you're hearing this after the 4th of July, hopefully the summer's going well for you. And we look forward to talking again soon and you're tuning into our podcast. Take care.